You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey, everybody. So we're back with part two. Nick is actually in transit at the moment. So I am here with our guest, Jillian.
Hey, Alex.
Without Nick, I always love a great opportunity to just remove Nick from the equation. And this was perfect. So thank you for hopping back on quickly to dig
into him. Yeah, no problem. Well, it seems like Nick removed himself. What did this clown do? Why are we here? This is his fault,
okay,
right?
So Nick is coming out to California because his wife is in grad school in San Diego. So
yes.
Sarah. He's been pushing off the trip over and over again. I've done this with Sarah too, actually. We went down and visited her and had a nice little chat that Nick had no control over.
Fantastic.
So he's traveling, and I guess somehow, I don't know how you lose your laptop at JFK. Like, maybe he left it on the conveyor belt, or I don't know. I don't understand how it's actually humanly possible to leave
it's
your computer
funny.
At the airport.
It's funny because, and this was completely unplanned, listeners, like I knew about that I was recording with Alex not 5 minutes ago, but Patrick Hines has done that after we've come back from live shows or like conventions or whatever. There was one time, I think it was JFK, he left his laptop on the plane. It was like in the little front, in the seat compartment in front of you thing. And you're just like, one, we were so exhausted and just ready to get home. So on the way home, I understand it more.
Maybe
but going
that makes sense,
you know, because I feel like if you're going
he
there
had a layover because he's a cheap bastard, so he probably bought like a four stop ticket for like $80.
I feel like by the time you're on your way home, you're so sick and tired of doing like the keys wallet phone dance, like keys wallet phone iPad, like I can see, but of course leave it to Nick on the way there. Also, that's just a nightmare. All jokes aside,
a nightmare. No, he's not having a great time based on the short conversation that I had with him. So before we dive into part two, we've already gone through Nick's choice of Catch Me If You Can, which is a great film. And we're moving on towards our choices now. Is there any Nick trivia that you have that you wouldn't want anybody to know, or he wouldn't want anybody to know, but we want everybody to know?
Oh, my God.
There's got to be something.
There's got to be, right? He told me a story about how he almost missed his cue in Hamilton because he was eating cereal in his dressing room. But he said that on the podcast, so he told everybody. But I was like, Nick, you know Tommy Kail listens to this, right? Like, cereal? Cereal is almost what delayed the show. Cereal.
Nick's bachelor party I planned. We rented a house in upstate New York. The only request that he had was cereal. So we went up, we rented a whole passenger van with like 15 people and went to this weird house in the middle of nowhere. And we had probably 15 or 16 boxes of cereal. And we bought a bunch of Nerf guns and just hung out in this like weird forest mansion all weekend. And it was actually pretty amazing.
The last time Nick was on the podcast, Nick and Sarah were on the podcast and he was talking about cereal and the look on her face. I was just like, Sarah, she was like, it's messy. It's like there's just like cereal crumbs everywhere. Like this cereal thing is kind of it haunts him in some way. But it's his like major vice is cereal.
Yeah. It's because he refuses to grow up.
That's it. That's exactly That's right. It.
So with that being said, onward to part two.
Little justice. Little justice. Little justice.
So I guess I'll just line it up because I've already started. I don't know if you guys are going to get this or not. So I wanted to pick something because we've got, you know, a true crime expert in here and we've got Steven Spielberg Walker here.
Shut up.
So I figured I wanted to find something a little more obscure, a little more that's like a really great movie that tells the story really well that maybe a lot of people haven't seen and they should. So this film starts on 50s old newsreel footage. And it is a tourism video for Christchurch, New Zealand. Beautiful streets, people riding bikes. It's all very positive, and it goes on for a while. It's just a couple straight minutes. The schools are great, and here they are going to church, and here's Sally doing this, and everybody's happy and all that. And then all of a sudden, in the span of like 10 seconds, the music just gets really moldy and dark and all that, and you cut to a forest. The screen widens up. And there's two girls running through the forest just screaming their heads off. And they're rushing along this hiking path.
Wait.
And they rush up a hill.
Wait.
And they're screaming. They break out to the top at this house. And this lady comes running out like, what's wrong?
Alex,
and the camera cuts. And they're just staring into the camera, screaming, covered in blood.
Is this movie
about how somebody's died?
Is this directed by Peter Jackson?
It is.
Yes!
And the movie is
Heavenly Creatures.
Oh, I wish James Mason would do a religious picture. He'd be perfect as Jesus. Daddy says the Bible's a load of bunkum. But we're all going to heaven. I'm not. I'm going to the fourth world. It's an absolute paradise of music, art, and pure enjoyment. James will be there, and Mario. Only they'll be saints. Saint Mario.
I was afraid this was going to happen. I haven't seen it.
No, it's fine. That's fine.
I was afraid
that's,
of this.
That's fine.
Okay. That's exactly
all good. I mean, I'm glad that I picked something so out there.
Yeah.
You really should see this movie.
It sounds like I'm going to watch it through my hands. It sounds terrifying.
No. It's not. So it's actually, so the movie is about two girls, Juliet Hume and Pauline Parker, who are real people who form a friendship, right? One of them's kind of this social outcast girl. She's always angry and never talking to people. And this girl from England moves into town and they become fast friends to the point where you're not really sure what the relationship even is. It's based on a real crime where they form such a bond that when the parents decided to split them apart and they wanted to take this girl back across overseas, they came up with a plan to kill the one's mother, and they did it. Fast forward for, you know, after the story takes place, they kill the mother. They go to jail for 5 years. When she gets out, when Juliet Hume gets out, she takes another name, Anne Perry, and moves away and becomes like a world famous true crime author. It's not in the movie that happens, but in reality, the person that this is based on wrote like best selling novels for her entire career. After only serving, crazy. But so the movie is Peter Jackson, who did Lord of the Rings, right? It's the only movie he did in between his early like monster creature features, Dead Alive or Brain Dead and Bad Taste, which are like puppet blood, crazy cartoony horror, you know, almost horror comedies with how crazy they are. And he did The Frighteners too. But this was like his one serious movie, and it got nominated for Best Original Screenplay. And I think it's what gave the studio confidence that he could go off and do Lord of the Rings. It's also the feature film debut of Kate Winslet and Melanie Lynskey, who played the two girls. It's phenomenal. So the story, why I love it as a true crime story is because, you know, from the beginning, if you're watching it, there's a little card that prompts it. Like, you know what happens at the end. So you're waiting for it. It doesn't get to the point where they decide to do it until the very end. Like, it's not like halfway through the movie, the one's like, we should kill them, and they plot it out. And it's not like a murder story. It's about these two girls who really don't fit in anywhere, really finding this bond with each other, really only understanding each other. And the movie uses fantasy sequences and things. They like decide to write a fantasy book together and they live in this world that they've developed and their reality starts blending with it. So the character, you know, the parents and the teachers and everybody they're interacting with, they start to kind of cast them into this fantasy story they're telling. Kind of got like a Labyrinth vibe almost. And it's a fascinating way to kind of portray the inner turmoil of teenage girls.
Charles!
Gina! It's great to see you here.
Diello.
Careful, Gina. We almost lost you. For you, my lady.
You know, and everything starts working against them. And, the you know, it's the parents who initially, all the parents are good people in the beginning. You all start to, you know, oh, well, one's cheating and one's angry and one's doing this and one's doing that. And they get so, the rest of the world stops making sense to them. So they only have each other. They cling tighter to each other. And so when they're finally torn apart at the end, it's like this tightly wound bomb.
It's a 3X story with a tragic end. Your mother is rather a miserable woman, isn't she? I thought for hours about whether Carmelita should accept Bernard's marriage proposal. I think she knows what's going to happen. She doesn't appear to bear us any grudge. But in the end, I decided against it. I thought it would spoil all their fun.
And it brings you to understand how they could kill somebody.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Because it's threatening the only thing that's giving them, that's making the world make any kind of sense. Because they feel like if they didn't do it, then they would die.
Yeah, Alex, talk a little bit about the world. Tell Julian a little bit more about the world that they create with each other. Because like that, I think the fantastical element of this.
It's
movie.
Amazing. So Weta Workshop was created for this film. And I think it's fascinating because it's not... It's a drama, right? It's a character drama. It's not a fantasy movie. It's not a horror movie. It's not, you wouldn't think that one of the leading special effects studio in the world would have started with a story about, you know, teenage lesbians.
Right.
They start writing about this world. It's called Baravnia. It's like a fantasy kingdom, you know, with kings and princes and swords and all these things. In addition, they start making these little clay characters. And so what they do is they built an entire set and costumes with people who look like human-sized clay characters.
It's insane.
And they just have these girls. It's crazy. It's like not, you know, it's not real looking, but it's just like they look like just giant, poorly molded clay figurines, but they really look like that. Like the costumes are so well done
it kind of borders this line that I think, and it makes me think of another Peter Jackson film that I don't know if everyone's, or maybe you guys, did either of you see The Lovely Bones?
No, I actually never did.
So Lovely Bones is pretty much like kind of the same, a lot of the same concepts, mm-hmm. right? Like you take a, this, you know, obviously the murder in The Lovely Bones isn't real, but you take a murder and you make it into a, you bring in like elements of magical realism and you just make it a very interesting, you know, crazy world. Stanley Tucci was nominated for best supporting as the killer in that movie, and he's terrifying. But like it really is these things where it blends kind of what I think Peter Jackson is best at, which is like taking elements that at turns, like right instantaneously, can go from heartwarming and like beautiful to like slightly disturbing,
mm-hmm.
and that's what this you know, when you're watching these young women dance in this clay castle like thing, I mean, I just remember being like, what the hell? Like, it's very strange, and like the smiles are just plastered on these guys.
It's very creepy and they start to cast the characters against it, right? And they start to see, you know, one of the girls goes to see a psychologist because her mother is worried that she's gay. So she sends her to have this conversation with a psychologist about how, it's, you know, it's just a phase or whatever. And by the end of the thing, she's fantasizing about a clay guy coming up and stabbing him through the back. And they go through the whole sequence and then it cuts and none of that actually happened.
Perhaps you could think about spending more time with boys.
You don't want to hurt Juliet's feelings, but I'm sure she'd understand you're having other interests outside of the friendship. I mean, there's all sorts of clubs and hobbies that you can...
Bloody fool.
Mrs. Reaper.
And suddenly you understand why they can commit
and
murder.
Suddenly you understand, you know, like, and I mean, fuck? I guess it's something that's been beaten to death in other things, but like it, the way it's used is very poignant.
Yeah.
visual language where you follow these girls, you know, in a positive way through their fantasy land and you get their connection to it and it connects each other, right? They start writing, when they get separated, they start writing each other letters in the voices of these characters they've created. Like they really use this world to be their language. So when they bring it into their own situations, you understand what it means to them and how it relates. It's like without needing to, like, if you're trying to explain how do you get somebody to murder? How do you push somebody to murder? Especially a 15, 16 year old girl, it tackles it in such a unique and poignant way.
I'm riveted by this. Riveted.
Please go watch the movie because it really is a beautiful,
heavenly
film.
Heavenly creatures. It's phenomenal. And Peter Jackson, I mean, I won't say it's my favorite Peter Jackson because Lord of the Rings, but second favorite.
I was picked up at 2 p.m. I've been very sweet and good. I have worked out a little more of our plan. Peculiarly enough, I have no qualms of conscience. I rose late and helped Mother vigorously this morning. Deborah rang, and we decided to use a rock and a stocking rather than a sandbag. We discussed the moiter fully. I feel very keyed up, as though I were planning a surprise party. Mother has fallen in with everything beautifully, and the happy event is to take place tomorrow afternoon. Next time I write in this diary, Mother will be dead.
See, I know this is going to be controversial. I might throw King Kong in there, and I know that you're going to kill me for that.
King Kong. No. No.
Yeah.
I love it. I love King Kong. Yeah.
Good film. Good film.
I have nothing bad to say about King Kong. I have nothing phenomenal to say about King Kong.
I know.
Nick, but did I ever tell you...
It comes from a good place.
Nick, did I ever tell you my Peter Jackson story of when I met him?
You're going to tell me now.
Okay. And Alex, for you too. I'm going to take, this is going to be quick, but of course it relates to true crime because like this is just who I am. So a dear, dear, dear friend of mine and of Mike's is Damien Eccles. And Damien Eccles is a person who was wrongfully imprisoned and on death row. So he was in prison for 18 years and I think 75 days and 10 of those years was solitary. And it's a case, it's called the West Memphis Three. That's his case. And Peter Jackson, there were a Paradise Lost series Joe Berlinger did. That was the HBO documentary. And then West of Memphis came out. But there was a lot of celebrity attention on this case because of the HBO series. And Peter Jackson was one of the people who came forward and helped bankroll the investigations and helped get them out of prison. So Damien, cool. Jesse, and Jason had to sign an Alford plea, which means that they maintain their innocence but, quote, plead guilty just so they can get out because Damien was dying in prison. So they're out. But so, and that Peter Jackson, it costs a lot of money to do the investigation, especially when the state of Arkansas wants to kill you and they don't want to admit any wrongdoing. So Peter Jackson, it was like Peter Jackson, Johnny Depp, Henry Rollins, the Dixie Chicks, Natalie Maines, especially. Natalie Maines is such a badass hero, but she was very, very vocal. And so we went to one of Damien's art shows in LA, and because Lori, his wife, and Damien got very, very close with Fran and Pete, as they call them, which is so bizarre. We'll be at dinner and Lori's like, oh, Fran and Pete. And I'm like, you mean like Fran Walsh and Peter Jackson, like that Fran and Pete. Cool. Cause they're just like friends. And so he was there. And so, Mike is such a fan of Lord of the Rings. And so we met him and Lori was like, you know, here, Lori's the sweetest person in the world. And she was like, here are the, you know, the sweet friends we've told you about, Mike and Jillian. And we just said to him, like, we didn't talk about his movies at all. We just said like, thank you for saving our friend's life and getting and doing what you could to like get him out. And so, Peter Jackson was like really lovely and like came to Damien's art show. It was in LA at the time. And he was just a really, he's a cool guy, and he threw his money at something very meaningful. And so I always like telling that story. Not because it's not like any street cred for me, or a humble brag for me. It's cool that I met Peter Jackson, but it's even cooler that he threw his money at the cause of getting three innocent men out of prison.
That's what we want to hear. That's what we right? like. We right? like, I like those stories where people are good people. I really do think that's a great
that's the
thing.
Goal. I want to have as much money to get all the thousands of innocent people in prison. I want them out. That's
can we
that's
please
the goal.
Do that? Can we
yeah,
do
yeah. Sad. I want to save all the animals and get all the innocent people out of prison. That's oh my whole that's my whole thing.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're gonna take a quick an advertisement break to pay for things, but when we come back, we will have some money movie money. Choices for you. We will be right back.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And we are back. We are back. We are back. And in the meantime, I want to hear about your movie, which, Alex, I have to admit, I do believe I know. So I'm
you
not going
to. You sound very sure about it. You know exactly what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my film is it opens on July 4th. And it's a tracking shot, and it's from the. We're looking out the passenger side of a car, and a car, it's like going through a neighborhood, and we're going house by house by house by house, and finally we stop on a house. Does someone have a guess? What am I hearing?
I didn't choose this. I would have chosen it, and it's another, like, literally you guys chose the two that I was gonna choose until I realized nah, there's too good a chance.
It is my favorite movie other than That Thing You Do and Clue. It actually has to do with what True Crime Obsessed was originally going to be. Can I say it?
Go for it.
Yes, please.
Zodiac.
Dear editor, this is the murderer of the two teenagers last Christmas at Lake Herman and the girl on the 4th of July near the golf course in Vallejo. To prove I killed them, I shall state some facts which only I and the police know. Christmas, brand name of ammo, Super X. 10 shots were fired. The boy was on his back with his feet to the car. The girl.
Here is part of a cipher. The other two parts of this cipher are being mailed to the editors of the Vallejo Times and SF Examiner. I want you to print this cipher on the front page of your paper. In this cipher is my identity. If you do not print this cipher by the afternoon of FRY, 1st of Aug 69, I will go on a kill rampage Fry night. I will cruise around all weekend killing lone people in the night, then move on to kill again until I end up with a dozen people over the weekend. It's unsigned except for a symbol.
Is it me? Or does that look like a gun sign?
Yeah.
Boom. I love this movie so hard.
It is. Okay. Can I just talk about it for a second?
Go off. It's time. Jeez. The time is now.
So I read Helter Skelter like way too young, and Charles Manson and that whole story is what got me into true crime, reading Helter Skelter. And then the next book I read was Robert Graysmith's book. And like, I'm talking notes in the margin. I was going to get the guy. Like from a young age, I've always wanted to get the guy. So when Zodiac came out, and it's like Mark Ruffalo, who I'm obsessed with, Chloe Sevigny, who's incredible, and no one gives her any credit for that comedic performance in Big Love. She was phenomenal in that show. We have Robert Downey Jr. We have Jake Gyllenhaal. It's the best. But I saw that movie at midnight when like no one was in the theater. I went to like the 12:01 showing of Zodiac, and it was so, because I'm a purist, right? And this is what we do on True Crime Obsessed. Like, if we're going to be laughing at shit revolving this story, I'm going to get every name right. I'm going to get every date right. I want to do everyone as much justice as I possibly can as a dumb podcaster. So if we're going to be laughing about the lawyer, I'm going to get the victim's name right. I'm going to get her sister's name right. You know what I mean? That's very, very important to me to not be like, yeah, I think her name was Kathy or whatever. Like, no, I'm going to know her fucking middle name. I'm going to Google it. I'm going to make sure we know that. So I remember being in the theater and thinking, I've seen this before. That's how accurate some of the scenes in Zodiac were compared to the book. Because it felt like, wait, I was having deja vu. And I realized, no, it's just Fincher being Fincher. That's it. It's just like dark and 70s and wonderful. And so I think it's really about not just trying to figure out who this guy is. It's what the obsession with true crime and the obsession with this case did to the people reporting it and the people who were affected by it, who were not the victims. And it sounds cruel to say, because I think they did the victims justice in Zodiac, which I think is very, very important. But it's how, you know, Robert Downey Jr.'s character, like Paul Avery, he became obsessed with the case. Robert Graysmith, Dave Toskey, like every year when Dave Toskey, the anniversary of the Paul Stein murder on Washington and Cherry, like up until his death, every year on that date, the real Toskey would go to that corner and just sit there and try to like get something new. Feel something new, like anything to help the case. This consumed people. And it is, I think it's 2.5 hours, and my only complaint is that it's too short.
Somebody else is here.
It is a public park.
I think he's watching us.
Well, we're very good looking.
We're behind that tree.
All right, so he's taking a leak.
He's coming towards us. Oh my god, he has a gun.
Don't move.
Can I ask you this? Can you speak a little bit about the depiction of the murders of Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd? Because that scene, that sequence, like, I can't.
Yeah,
I actually
the one
can't,
out by the lake.
Yes,
it's like
I can't. Well, I can ever watch. Talk to me about that.
Well, I will as much as I can. It's what I skip every time.
Yep.
And yep. I skip it every time. And Mike knows it's coming. And he gets the remote. He knows I'm very sensitive to that. But so what happens is, and this is very, this was one of the things, one of the scenes that made me feel like I've seen this before. Nope, it's just Fincher perfectly recreating one of the most terrifying things that's ever happened. So this couple is out at Lake Berryessa. It's the middle of the day. There are no real trees. They're like yards away from any kind of tree or brush area. They are out in the open. It's the middle of the day. It's everyone on earth is like, oh, they're safe. It's 2 p.m. Like there's no way any harm can come to them because that's what we think, right? It's the middle of the day. I'm outside. There's like nowhere to hide here. It's totally fine. And this person approaches them wearing this horrifying outfit, this mask and all this stuff. And he brutally murders them. First, he lies to them and says, you know, I just want money or whatever. And the boyfriend tries really hard to calm down his girlfriend. And the way Fincher films it is so moving and so effective because the terror, and that actress is absolutely
phenomenal.
Unbelievable. The absolute terror in her eyes. And it's a brutal stabbing. So, I can't watch it. It's too much. It's too real. It's too scary. It's too sad. Like, fuck this guy. Fuck the Zodiac. Like, he sucks. And it's, you see it from the boyfriend's point of view. And she's crying. And then, like, he goes back and he stabs the boyfriend and he stabs her. And it's just like, it is such a fear that's realized. Because, again, it's the middle of the day. No, everyone thinks you're safe when all the lights are on. And you're not. And the 70s were the worst. Like we just did I'll Be Gone in the Dark on True Crime Obsessed. Like, and we came out of doing that series and the big takeaway was fuck the 70s. Like nobody cared about women. Like rape was an afterthought and the 70s were just like a nightmare. So that is the scene that I skip, but it's a very important murder in the case. So I understand why Fincher took took all that time to show us that.
No, it truly is it's a moment where you just, where number one, because of the attention to detail of this movie,
yeah,
you know that this is, it's just a scene that just brings home the gravity of exactly what this person was doing. And not only that, but the, you talk about respect to the victims. I mean, it really, you know, there, it actually is not, it's not gory. It's not it, that, that's kind of why it's so effective, is it's not about the amount of blood or the, it's just about watching these two poor kids have to watch each other get stabbed. And it's just like fucking believably uncomfortable.
And the thing is, like, Ruffalo, like Dave Toski, who was another just brilliant mind, he was the main inspector on the case. They called him inspector back then. But he says, you know, Zodiac was too busy killing the women that he forgets to finish off the men. So we have eyewitness statements, of course, traumatized, injured, near death, but two of the boys lived, and so they can tell these stories. And it's just like, it really hits home as a woman too, because she's the one in that scene, she's the one who notices there's some guy like lurking around the trees.
Yep.
And the boyfriend, and I'm not victim blaming at all, but this is just life. And the boyfriend's like, it's fine, again, it's 2 p.m, don't worry about it.
Yep.
But as a woman, like, I say this on True Crime Obsessed all the time, and Patrick is always like, oh my God, to be a woman in this world is a nightmare. And I'm like, it sure is. But like, you always know the guy in the room or the guys in the bar to have your eye on, always. Like, to the ladies listening at home, they know exactly what I'm saying. It's always like, all right, I don't like that guy, so I'm going to know where he is all the time. And I'm probably not going to use the bathroom until he's far enough away from it where I feel safe that I can walk there without being, you know, whatever. And so that felt very real too, that she was the one that was like, she felt it. She knew, because that's what it's like to be a woman in the world.
That's fucking awful. And yeah. I mean, all I can say is, you know, fuck that. And I'm so sorry that that's a real, no, and it's the truth, because, you know, even with Sarah, you know, we, you know, there's so much that I have realized that, you know, even as a black man, I'm still a man and have not had to deal with. And the idea that you are in these spaces and cannot feel safe or have to have an awareness about you, cannot ever let your guard down. And I think that speaks to so much of what the movie is talking about too, was this time when we didn't understand. I mean, that, you know, I think the beauty of having true crime be a genre or a podcast genre or just a genre that people are interested in now, the silver lining of this is that people are more aware of what can happen in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because I think that's kind of what made the Zodiac and other crimes of that era so astounding, was that, you know, I mean, that's the entirety of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is like the destruction of innocence, right? The idea that this world is safe and happy and free and everybody's here to help you. Like, that's finding out that, nope, there's people who are just really fucked up. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're like really amazing, just film, just cinematic choices and things that Fincher does. Like, every time, because we see the Zodiac a few times in this, and he's played by a different actor every time. So it's not like the guy who plays Arthur Lee Allen is playing the role of the murderer at Lake Berryessa, Darlene Farren, Ione Skye. Like, he's not,
wow.
he's it's not the same actor, because we never see his face. We just hear his voice. And because there were so many different composites, and again, these people were dealing with trauma after encountering this person, or, you know, that great scene, that infuriating scene with Mark Ruffalo talking to the kids on the stairs after the Paul Stein murder. And they're like, he looked normal. And he's like, what, normal? Like, and they said it was a black guy first. And so there were two cops who actually walked by him. Like, that's all true. Like, they walked by the Zodiac killer who killed Paul Stein. Like, if we didn't blame the black guy right away, we could have saved so many lives. You know what I mean?
Jesus
like
Christ.
Like, the call went out that it was like an African American guy, and so these cops see this like this piece of shit like lumbering along, and they kind of did a double take, and instead of questioning him, they just let him go, because over the radio the description was something else. It was corrected quickly, but not fast enough. In the 70s, how fast can that go?
Oh my God.
Oof. You know?
I'm going to be honest. I'm sitting here in my apartment, and as we have the discussion, the way that I'm looking over my shoulder into the hallway behind me, I just want to be clear about that, because that's my life now.
Check the lock on the front
door. Abso-fucking-lutely checking that lock.
So here's how Zodiac relates to True Crime Obsessed. When Patrick and I became really good friends and we're going to happy hour 6 days a week or whatever, and our conversations went to true crime, and I had this thing. I was like, I want to make a true crime podcast, and I don't know what it's going to be, but so I called Patrick, and it was kind of a thing. Like, I like went into our room and I was like, Mike, I'm going to make this phone call. It was like a serious phone call. It was like a big, like, kind of pitch, but I didn't have a pitch. And so I was like, I want to make a true crime podcast. I want to do it with you. I don't know what it is. Let's get drinks and figure it out. And the first idea for the podcast was, we're going to solve the Zodiac. And it was like, I made a graphic based on the ciphers, like the code that he sent to the paper. I was like, I'm going to be like Robert Graysmith. I'm going to go to the library. Like, it was a whole, I was like, we're going to do this. We're going to fucking solve the Zodiac. We're going to get him. And then we realized very, like, a week into my research, I was like, I feel like there are more qualified people to do this. I feel like it has to be solved somehow. It kind of already is, but I feel like maybe I am just making a mockery of this case. If I was like, I think I just love the movie and I think I'm just fascinated by the case. Like, this is really not on me. And that was like the original idea for True Crime Obsessed, was to solve the Zodiac.
I mean, listen, if there's anyone who could do it, it's absolutely you. there's no doubt in my mind that you can.
I mean, I don't think Fincher's wrong. I think I always lean towards Arthur Lee Allen. I did when I read the book, and I know Graysmith is biased in that sense, but come on.
It seemed the case is definitely made, especially that gentleman, I have to look his name up, because he always plays this exact role.
Is he the one who played Drew Carey's brother on the Drew Carey show? That guy?
Yes.
That dude's in everything, and he's excellent in everything he's in.
Yeah.
Truly excellent.
He was also in Big Love with Chloe Sevigny.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
And my favorite one that he was in.
It's John something something. It's another, it's like Arthur Lee
Allen.
John
Carroll Lynch.
Yes,
John Carroll Lynch. A brilliant actor. I first saw John Carroll Lynch in, this is going to make you guys mad. Remember, was it Volcano with Tommy Lee Jones? Is that the name of the movie?
Yes.
Where he,
love Volcano.
Where he plays a subway worker who is trapped underground and is getting people off this subway as the lava comes in. And there's this epic sequence where he jumps. So like, the lava has now gone under the train, right? He has to jump to like the side of the tracks that doesn't have lava, but there's still a little girl on the train. So he picks up the little girl and everybody's like, jump, you can do it. He's like, I'm not going to make it. They're like, you can do it. And this man, and it's like, it actually is very heartbreaking, because he jumps and he just does not make it. Like, literally lands in the lava and is like melting, but uses his last ounce of consciousness and strength to like chuck this girl
across. That's funny.
And he's just like, and you watch him die and you're like, God damn it, John Carroll Lynch, you're amazing. Oh my God.
So, oh my God. Mike just came in and brought the dogs.
Holy crap.
We're not on camera.
I love it. We're no cameras here, but it's brilliant that you just.
If anyone would appreciate this, it would be Nick Walker. Because
prankster like Nick Walker.
A good old fashioned sabotage move a little bit.
Yeah.
You did sabotage, but it's
just
a brilliant.
The stairs with a Shipu in my arms. And
Pete, the mix Pete, of everything. Yeah.
I lured him.
So welcome, Seb.
But they say hi.
Well, Mike can't hear you because I have headphones on, but.
But I mean, what I was going to ask was, now that he's here, I mean, because I wanted to ask really quickly for our listeners what you're up to, and part of what you're up to involves Mike.
I wanted to do that at the end because I still have more to say about Zodiac, but we'll pitch what we're working on.
Well, amazing. Hi guys, I can't wait to come on. And the only other thing I can say is the hurly burly man.
Oh my God, stop it. Please stop. This is fucking terrifying. I can't do that. I can't do that. I'm already, like I said, I'm staring over my shoulder. Like, I can't deal with that right now.
Alex, thank you. As a fellow editor, I apologize. And also thank you for what you're going to do.
I got
with
a hell of a
thank
weekend you. Ahead of me.
No, this might look what I mean. This might need to be a two-parter, y'all. Cause this is, we got some stuff. We got some stuff to talk about.
I have like a lot more. Here's the thing. Zodiac was like, before Hamilton was like, Zodiac was the thing where I was like, does anyone, and like, I'd walk into a party and be like, does anyone want to talk about Zodiac at all? Like the movie or the case, like they'd be like, no. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, is there a dog here for me to hang out with? Or like, what am I supposed to do here exactly?
Oh my God.
But there are other like little tiny things that, that I love that Fincher does, like just little moments where, like, even in the because like that intro that I was describing, like when they go, it's like the Darlene Farren murder, and after that, it's like before the credits, and then they have the bump, 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 bump. They have that Santana song on, like while like they do like the on-screen text credits, and yeah. We follow. Like, I love that Fincher's like, fuck this. We have way too much to get to. This movie's gonna be 2.5 hours long. We're like immediately at the San Francisco Chronicle, which I just love. Like, he doesn't waste any time.
But oh no.
As we're seeing the opening credits on text, it's like the old typewriter thing, and as they fade out, they fade into the characters of the code that he wrote. Which is just a cool, like, just so my speed, like, just it ticks like every box on the Will Jillian Love This list, and little things like how Dave Toskey used to wear, like, there's a moment where Jake Gyllenhaal as Robert Graysmith says to Nick's boyfriend Robert Downey Jr., who is basically playing like a drunk Tony Stark in the 70s, which is phenomenal.
He is.
Like, that's exactly who Paul Avery was in this version of it, and because he's like in awe of Dave Toskey, and Jake Gyllenhaal goes, oh, he wears his gun like Bullet. And Robert Downey Jr. says McQueen stole that from Toskey. And that's true. Like, that's a real story. Like, Toskey wore his holster around his arm, like on the shoulder or whatever. And yeah. Steve McQueen, like, Dave Toskey was so big even before Zodiac. Like, he was like such a mainstay that Steve McQueen stole that as Bullet, which I think is like such a cool little throwaway line, but it's very cool.
Well, talk to me about this then. Talk to me about this, because with these three, you know, you have Dave Toskey, you have Robert Graysmith, you have Paul Avery. These three people who are coming at this thing from three distinct sides. I mean, yeah. You know, and one of the things that I think really hit me when I watched the movie was how, I'm not going to say loose their connection. It was very like L.A. Confidential, where these people, like, because, you know, from the way the movie was advertised, not knowing anything about the true crime of it all, I was like, okay, I'm going to watch Robert Downey Jr., Jake Gyllenhaal, and Mark Ruffalo solve a case.
Sure.
But it's not, they're very much in their own universes. Like, there's no, that's kind of the thing that I think keeps it in a true crime world. It's like David Fincher very much resists the urge to like team them all up and bring them all together to solve the crime. It's like, nope, they kind of cross paths. You know, Paul Avery and Robert Graysmith had this, you know, maybe kind of friendship that you kind of like see hints of. You know, them at the bar together.
I love that.
No. Oh, it's great.
This can no longer be ignored.
I didn't know he was going to send another code.
I just guessed.
Just guessed?
The first one seemed too easy. Right.
This can no longer be ignored. What is that you're drinking?
It's an aqua velva. We wouldn't make fun of it if you tried it.
With the aquafaba.
Oh, it's
that
so
is
good.
One of my favorite, and that of course became one of my favorite drinks because it is absolutely delicious and it looks
is
cool
it really?
And blue.
I've never
it's
had
so
one.
Good. It's so good. This can no longer be ignored. And Robert Graysmith with the truth says you wouldn't make fun of it if you tried it. And then cut to drunk Robert Downey Jr. with six empty glasses around him. I'm like, yeah, that's me.
Oh my God. Oh my God. No, but so I mean, but yeah, so it really is this thing, right? Where they never really kind of got on the same page, it seems. Like they
No, and Paul Avery and Toskey were at odds with each other because Paul Avery was there to sell papers, you know, like he covered crime in Vallejo, as he says. He, you know, was the crime writer. And so he like loved the attention and the drama of it all. And Dave Toskey was there to get the guy. And Robert Graysmith was almost, you know, as the cartoonist of the Chronicle, really like had no place being in any of these conversations, which Fincher makes very clear early on. Like, they kick him out of the editorial meetings. And so it's very interesting, like, how Graysmith was an observer, really, like a spectator in all of this, and became so entrenched. And then years later, he finally gets face to face with Toskey, who's been like beaten down with this case. His own partner is like, I can't do this anymore. Like, it's just, it's too much. Like, it's, they're just like running into these dead ends over and over and over again. And Toskey is like all beaten down, and Graysmith is like still at 100. Like, Graysmith is still ready to go. And so, like, it's an interesting dynamic of these three people who have a little bit of the same goal. I think Avery really was in it for the the drama, and in a little bit, I mean, not to speak ill of the dead, but I think he loved, you know, his column was really popular at the time, and he wasn't in it, I think, in the same way Toski and Gray Smith were. And when they eventually start working together in this cool little, you know, I can't tell you that, but maybe Ken Narlow and Napa Ken, you know, that's a cool.
Yeah.
Those little secret meetings were always very fun. And then you have Brian Cox just being Brian Cox.
Yes. There should be a book called Being Brian Cox.
Brian Cox, who will do like Succession, which is an amazing show, and everything. Cox. And yep. Also like Super Troopers and McDonald's voiceover commercials. Like Brian Cox is just like here for all of it.
He's there for everything. And then he also plays Hannibal Lecter on the weekends. You know what I mean? Like, let's go back to Manhunter. And this man shows up and he says, oh, yeah, I'm actually the original Hannibal Lecter. And now here we are.
Right. The incredible. Guy does it all.
He does it all. Like, kind of like you. Kind of like you, my friend.
Well, look, are you happy that I didn't... Are you happy that I didn't choose the Hamill film because Hamilton is true crime? I could have chosen the Hamill film for this.
I mean,
very technically, you are right.
You are actually correct. Wow. That I'm
the vice president killed the Treasury Secretary. Hamilton is true crime through and through. I will die on this hill. No pun intended.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree with you. I think that if you had chosen the Hamill film, I would have probably walked off.
I never would do that to you. I would never. And also, like I would never do that to me. Like there are two people who are very nicely indulging me about Zodiac. I'm not giving that
no
up for
there's
anything.
No, well, there's no indulgence. Zodiac is a wonderful film, and again, yeah. I please watch Zodiac if you and yeah. I would suggest watching it at a time.
It's very, very similar to a movie we've done, another Jake Gyllenhaal crime movie that we did for the crime episode that I picked was Prisoners.
Yep.
those two about the people approaching a case differently, trying to solve a thing on their own terms and figuring it out on their own, their time and their terms. Prisoners is a great film.
Also very much, sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing.
I very much speaks to Jake Gyllenhaal as just a phenomenal actor.
He's the best.
He really is the best. And it's taken me a long time to understand that. But like now looking at his body of work and just looking at what he's been capable of, you're like, wow, you got something special here. Like you just have a range and a commitment.
If you haven't seen Nightcrawler,
oh my god,
Nightcrawler.
Oh, yeah. It's
by far my favorite Jake Gyllenhaal performance. I mean, the script is incredible too, but it's
my favorite. Wow. It was my favorite Jake Gyllenhaal until I saw John Mulaney and the Sack Lunch Bunch, and that became. Let me tell you, when you see Jake Gyllenhaal on that program. It will really, really do some things to your mind. But yeah, so Jillian, you know, but we could keep this going forever and ever, and we obviously have to have you back, and Mike will come on, and you will come back, and it will be great. But great. I do want to hear about this. So this thing that I want to hear about it because I'm involved in it. I'm in it.
Yeah. So there's we're gonna tease it a little. So Mike wrote this thing that we've done before, and so we get to work together, Nick, like officially in an official capacity, which I'm super excited about. So Mike and I have teamed up with Mischief Management, who this is. I will make like an 8-hour podcast about how much I love Melissa Anelli at Mischief Management. She is they're the people who put on like Broadway Con and Con of Thrones, and they are all about fandoms and bringing people together, and they're just excellent people. So we've teamed up with Mischief to produce this really fun thing, and that's really all I'm going to say at this moment about what it is. But we are, like everyone at Mischief, we've been working very closely with Melissa and Leah especially, and I just like, I can't believe it took me, like, I turned to Mike and I was like, I'm never going to not work with them on anything ever again. They're just like wonderful people. They are just so cool and so like down to business, but fun. Every time we have a meeting and I leave the meeting, I'm just like, I wasn't even feeling bad before the meeting, but I feel 100 times better all of a sudden. Like my mood is up. So we're going to do this really, really cool thing. It's a radio play that Mike wrote, and we're going to it's all about raising money for the Actors Fund. And we're just going to give you something fun and nice for the holidays. And we're getting the band back together without saying too much. We're maybe a little bit of Sons of Liberty and then some like fancy freestylers. That's enough of a tease. And also Nick Walker is going to be there.
I will show up at some point and say some
Alex,
words.
I'm sorry. Alex, yeah. will you still listen to the radio play even though Nick Walker's
absolutely.
Involved?
Well, that's what the mute button's for.
Right. I'll let you know. I'll give you timestamps so you can mute it.
I'll watch it in waveform. I've gotten very used to what Nick's voice looks like in waveform. Yeah. I can identify his ums without listening to it to cut them out. I just know exactly how he speaks.
That's so annoying.
I'll just listen in waveform and
just cut it out.
Yeah.
Just mute it. Yep.
So we have like big announcements coming, but I'm thrilled, Nick, that you said yes. Like I was like, if we could get Nick Walker, that would be so amazing.
It was No, that was a no-brainer.
Done. Yeah. So by the time Mike is on your pod, I think you can probably talk about it a little bit more. But it's like everyone, our dream cast said yes. You all said yes, cool. Like right away, which is unbelievable. So I'm excited to get some of two bands back together to make one big band. It's going to be great.
I love that. I love it. Well, Jillian, you are just nothing but a gem, and we are so thankful. Seriously, I mean
back
that.
Back at you.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for coming in, and
thank you so much
for talking to us.
Thank you for
this
having
movie.
Me. And if you of ever course. Want to talk about other, I mean, I'll find a way. Life finds a way. I will find a way to find a movie about the topic.
Absolutely. I mean, there are several other true crime movies to talk about. So like we could just do another go at this at some point. It could be fun.
Yeah.
But,
fake crime.
What if
fake
I was like, crime. I only talk about Zodiac. I just only talk about Zodiac.
Then we talk about Zodiac again.
I only talk about Zodiac or like Columbo, which is not true crime at all, but Peter Falk it's my favorite show. Columbo is my favorite show.
I always wanted to watch the remake with Ving Rhames, but I didn't hear good things. And I was like, nope, I'm going to leave that alone.
And there's this internet rumor or like the internet really wants Mark Ruffalo to play Columbo. And if that happens, that's just like, I'm done forever.
You
if
die.
Mark Ruffalo ever plays Columbo, which he could flawlessly, that would end me.
Well, let me tell you, we're living in a world where Jamie Foxx is coming back as Electro. In a new Spider-Man.
Wait, tell me.
Oh,
really?
Jamie Foxx is going to be Electro in Spider-Man 3. Returning? And not even in the franchise that he originally starred in a different Spider-Man franchise as the same character.
Wow.
So anything can happen, kids.
Maybe Jake Gyllenhaal will come back.
Oh, right? No. He is coming back because they're going to do the Sinister Six. It's going to be Jamie Foxx. It's going to... They're going to get all of them because they got Keaton, Foxx, Gyllenhaal. Who knows who's going to play Doc Ock? But it's going to be absolutely... crazy.
Alfred Molina, man.
Yeah, bring him
bring
back.
Him back. Bring him back.
He's like, what, probably in his 70s now.
Doesn't matter.
He's bringing back.
It's Alfred Molina. He can do anything. Just like John Carroll Lynch. He can
and Brian
do
Cox. Yes. Come on.
And Brian Cox. All
and
right.
Brian Cox. Oh, yeah, bring him in the X. Who did he Stryker in X-Men?
Oh, it was, what's his, yeah. What, was that was Brian Cox, wasn't it?
Stryker, Brian Cox, yeah.
Yeah. Aww.
In X-Men 2.
Oh, look at that. Look at that. All right, guys. Well, thank you, everyone. Stay safe out there. Take care of yourselves, and we will talk to you very soon. Bye.
Bye. Thanks, everybody.
Little justice. Fuck yeah.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.